stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 68 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I am Andrew Brokus, and at the moment I am coming to you solo. But don't worry, ladies, I'm going to be joined shortly by Nate Mavis and also by Mike McDonald. It's hard to imagine that there are many people listening who don't know who Mike McDonald is, but just in case you happen to be one of those people, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him before we get to the interview. Mike is one of the best tournament players in the world. He's a regular on the Super High Roller circuit. But you can also find him playing $20 MTTs online, where he plays as Timex. Personally, I find that kind of surprising, but we'll talk to him about why he still finds those smaller stakes tournaments, the smaller stakes online tournaments, to be worth his time. Most recently, Mike made poker history by winning the main event of the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure, making him the first person ever to win two European Poker Tour main events. And yes, for some reason, the PCA is on the European Poker Tour. Well, this is awkward. Turns out Mike McDonald did not actually win the PCA main event. I just did some pretty sloppy research. Mike actually took second place after they made a chop three-handed and played it out for I'm not sure how much money. He ended up winning a little over $1 million, still not too bad, although I'm sure he would have liked to get the W. So I apologize to anyone who is misled by that. In particular, I apologize to Mike. I promise, Mike, I was not trying to needle you. I just did some sloppy research. And thanks also to Rich Ryan, who pointed out this mistake to me. Okay, on with the show.
On top of all of that, Mike is just a hell of a nice guy. Nate and I both go way back with him, and he was extremely generous with his thoughts and his time during our interview. He even was willing to talk some strategy, so we're not going to have a separate strategy segment today. There's just a lot of Mike McDonald, and I started to say that I hope you'll enjoy it, but I am sure you'll enjoy it. Hey, Mike.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty well.
Thank you again for doing this with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. And do you know Nate?
Yeah, I haven't talked to him in a while, but we used to talk on AIM back a little bit, like 7 years ago or something.
Perfect. Yeah, almost exactly. You were somebody I knew on the internet. I remember a conversation about Pot Limit Omaha High Low. I remember a lot of 2+2 posts. I remember things like that. So that's, yeah. I would say we're sort of like 2+2 internet buddies-ish from a long time ago. But it's very nice to meet you in person. in person.
Meet you too.
Yeah, I'd like to think I could describe our relationship the same way. I guess you and I have actually never met in person, but I know we used to do a bit of AIM chat as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think when I first transitioned to MTTs was that team competition in May that you were a part of as well.
Yeah, I was actually, I wanted to make sure I told that story on the air because this was like the first time that you came to my attention. And we had been doing this contest. Do you remember what year this was? It was like 2005 maybe?
2006.
This is unbelievable, by the way. Wait, is this on the air?
Yeah,
this is unbelievable. I was talking about this challenge with Noah SD not a week ago. Just reference where he was like, hey, you remember that May challenge? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it was like, so I guess a couple of the most prominent people in the 2+2 MTT forum got to be like team captains, and then they would draft other people in the forum. And I think points were awarded your top X scores and like high, medium, low, and micro buy-ins or something like that. So I'm trying to think. I think I was a second round draft pick, and Steve JPA was the captain of the team. I think he took.
Ansky was the captain.
Oh, Ansky was the captain. I thought okay. Yeah. So I guess Ansky was the captain. He took Steve first.
Yeah.
And then I think he took me. And then the last person he took was this Timex person who I'd never like heard of before. And I think what little bit he or Steve told me about you was like, oh yeah, he's this kid I know who's like kind of interested in poker or something. And I mean, in retrospect, it was an amazing deal to get you as a last round draft pick. I think it was just that at that time, nobody really knew who you were except for Steve. But I think that was when you and I first connected on AIM. And I think I remember what in retrospect must have been really patronizing advice that I was giving you, thinking that you were just some like kid who was like just getting into tournaments. And then like once we started playing, I was like, I think you might even like won the most points or close to the most points for our team that month.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, like the advice wasn't really that patronizing because I truly was new to tournaments. Like I think I played my first MTT maybe 3 months earlier or something, and I was basically, you know, like 1 month earlier, I was grinding like 2180s. And even that month, I was mostly playing like 2180s and stuff. I just like, you know, took some shots at bigger tournaments and they went pretty well. But like, I think I ended up getting the most points in that competition, but it was purely variance. Like I was probably like, you know, average or below average in the competition and just like ran super hot at the start of my MTT career.
It definitely made me feel like an asshole to... Because I was thinking of you as just like almost like a pity pick, you know, like Steve was just taking you because you were like a friend of his or something, and then you like carried the team.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was sort of before anyone started grinding. Like that was probably 4 or 6 months before Sean Deeb started playing MTTs, and Sean seemed like, you know, about the first like true grinder who actually like 20 tabled or anything. Like back then, you know, the fact that I was playing 8 or 10 tables at a time was kind of unheard of. Like a lot of people during the month of May, their plan was to play 50 MTTs or something like that, and that was their month of grinding. And you know, for me, the fact that I, you know, I'm not sure what the number was, maybe I played 400 MTTs, which is still pretty low by today's standards, you know, put me as one of the highest volume players.
Well, there weren't that many MTTs you could play back. I mean, if you were adding like the 20 and 180s, you could kind of round out your screen. But I mean, how many three-figure buy-in tournaments were there in a day?
Yeah, no, there were so few of those, but there were still like, you know, I remember, you know, some people wouldn't even play 109 freezeouts and stuff like that. Like they'd be like, oh, you know, the 109 freezeouts are, you know, 8K to first. I'll just focus on the nightly 162 and the big 100 rebuy and maybe the 11 rebuy because it's such a big prize pool or something.
Yeah, then the super weekday tournaments on Party.
Yeah, exactly. Those are always good.
Well, so what was your entree into poker in general?
I first started playing poker, like the first time I ever played poker would have been about close to 10 years ago. I was at this like math camp, and at the math camp, just like the one day we had like a free night or something, and like someone brought out a set of poker chips, and like I didn't know the rules. Like I had played like blackjack before, and I had played like, you know, like 5-card draw or something, but I'd never really played Texas Hold'em. You know, we like just pulled out the set of poker chips, played some like sit and go, like whatever, 500 big blinds deep. And I just looked at the whole, like the hand rankings card and basically said, like, if I play a big pot, I'm going to have something that's like far down on the hand rankings card. So I probably won like 3% of hands or something. But since I was like always losing, you know, like 3 to 20 big blinds or winning a few hundred big blinds when I made like a straight or a flush or something, I think I ended up winning the first time that I played. And then I didn't play poker for a few more months. And then, I used to play a fair bit of chess, and my chess coach was starting to like supplement his income with online poker. This would have been end of 2004. So a little over 9 years ago. One day, like we were just kind of bored of playing chess, and he's like, oh, do you want to like learn some of the basics of poker? And I'm like, sure. So we were like, we hopped on, like Ultimate Bet, and we were just like watching like Prahlad Friedman playing like 2550 or something back in the day, like a spirit rock. And he was just like showing me like what these guys are doing, you know, why this guy's winning, why this guy's losing. And, you know, just kind of explaining some very like, you know, his impression of like why people were doing what they were doing. And then I just thought like, I thought this is pretty interesting. And he mentioned that, you know, a lot of good chess players, even though they were sick at chess and so-so at poker, were making more money playing poker than at chess. Mm-hmm. So then I thought this would be, you know, kind of a cool thing to try. And I just decided, you know, I'm going to put $100 online and play just small stakes limit hold'em. If I lose it, you know, go find another hobby. If it goes well, you know, stick with it. And then just, you know, started playing like 1 cent, 2 cent on UB just to like get used to playing online for real money. And then moved to 25 cent, 50 cent limit, then 50 cent a dollar, and just kind of, you know, I started out playing limit hold'em for about the first year and a half.
Those were also the days of Party Poker seeding every new account with $50, and you could just open as many of them as you felt like, right? Was that how it went?
Yeah.
It was something crazy.
I know one guy who's now like a pretty like established like high stakes pro basically got his start from every single day just, you know, getting getting a new account was $50 or $75, and then reformat his computer or whatever to clear any trace of Party Poker, get a new account, new name, and he'd do this every single day, get a new $50 or $75, sometimes even multiple times in a day, because they would track to make sure you hadn't had Party on your computer before, but it was pretty easy to change the settings so it couldn't detect, and he'd just do this once or twice a day, and get the $50 short stack, 1-2-0 limit, try to run it up. And that's how he started his bankroll and is now a high stakes pro.
Yeah. I'm not endorsing any of this. And in fact, I didn't do that, but it was the Wild West. I remember the first time, the only time I ever got a call from anybody about any transfer I made, I was shocked. In retrospect, it seems like something that should happen given what you would have to do to go to a bank, but I got a call from Poker Stars one day in 2008, I guess it would have been. It's like, oh, do you really want to send $X thousand to Mr. Y? And I was like, well, wow, yes, I do. And you guys have a security team? Like, what?
It was a different time back then.
Yeah, it was really something.
I mean, it's worked out well for you, and it seems like even at that time you had some sense of bankroll management where you're playing 1 cent, 2 cent, and deposited a reasonable amount of money and that kind of thing. I mean, as someone who had a lot of success playing online from when you were quite young, obviously there are political reasons why there are going to be age minimums, but independent of that, I mean, do you think that there should be, or do you think that in theory there's no reason why 14-year-olds shouldn't be allowed to play online poker?
I mean, I'm not an expert on this. I think, for me and my friends, I think it worked out pretty well. But for 99% of people, it didn't work out as well, kind of thing. Right. And, it not working out well could be anything from, wasting a Friday night and $50 to not going to college, losing their life savings and fucking up their future. So there's
and their parents' credit maybe as well.
Yeah, exactly. So they're worse than us could be, grinding out mid stakes and making a moderate income. The guys who I usually talk to are, in the top 1% or top, 0.01% of performers in poker. Right. So I have a very biased view on it. I would say if it were up to me, I feel casinos and gambling just wouldn't exist, because it's just one more way for dumb people to get fucked over by smart people, pretty much. Right. It's how I've made my living. But I'm
as
sure
a smart
that,
person, it works out well for you.
Yeah, but I'm sure that gambling and online poker does more net harm than net good to society.
Yeah. Are there other things you feel that way about? Surely, if you believe that, probably believe that a lot of other things shouldn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the same could be said about drinking and drugs and stuff. Basically, I don't want, what I'm saying is that I'm not the person to be making, political statements or anything like that. Cause one, I'm super ignorant about basically all issues, but two, it just seems like when something's less than a zero sum game, it's hard to argue that 14-year-olds should be doing it.
Yeah. I've always been a little bit interested about why poker players are so pro casino, and on the one hand it's kind of obvious because I like poker and I would like to be able to play poker right downtown. On the other hand, poker players see a lot of the downside and a lot of the nasty side of the game a lot more than other people do, and you would think there might be a little more of a anti-gambling backlash from the poker world, but nope, that pretty much never happens. I think you're one of the first people I've ever heard in the poker world say anything even close to extreme is the thing you just said. I mean, am I just talking to the wrong people, or would you say you're an extreme outlier in this regard?
I mean, it's not that I'm saying that I wish casinos didn't exist. Most people, when they're stating their viewpoints, they're not thinking from an outsider's point of view, what they think does the most amount of good. They're just thinking about what's best for them in this instance. You hear about, I don't follow American politics, but I know some politicians are pro online gambling, some are anti online gambling, and there's no one who plays online poker for a living and is really against online gambling because they know it does more harm than good for America. Like, that's just not a viewpoint that people are going to be actively supporting, even if objectively they think it's right. You know, people, there's just no way that you can't be self-interested to some extent. And I think that, you know, when your job requires a casino or requires an online poker site, you know, you're like, it's one thing to ask a question about, are online poker sites, you know, a net plus to society, or another one that says, am I glad that online poker sites exist? Like, fuck yeah, I'm glad that online poker sites exist. You know, I'm just saying that, like, you know, I think that, you know, I think as, you know, sum total, gambling probably does more harm than good.
That makes sense. And if I had to guess, I would guess that some of these attitudes were also behind your very famous decision to retire or quasi-retire from poker before you had even turned 21, just in hopes of doing more productive things. Is that right?
Honestly, like, not too much. Like, I'm not opposed to gambling. Like, I'm not, like, there are very few jobs where if I was doing that as my job, I would feel, you know, upset about it. Like, I think that, you know, if I was, whether as a poker or a trader, I think I would view those pretty similarly as far as, like, you know, like how I sleep at night. Like, I don't really think about that, and, you know, don't think too much about the fact that, you know, I'm not really adding too much to society. I don't think that my returning to poker, or my returning, like, to school and, like, taking, like, a year off poker was really, you know, I don't think it was too big of a factor that, you know, that gambling does, you know, more harm than good.
Makes sense. And you're happy you returned to school?
Yeah, I was. I mean, it's sort of weird to say that I was happy that I returned to school, given that, you know, I didn't end up getting a degree, which is usually the end goal from returning to school. But basically, I think the biggest thing that returning to school gave me was it kind of made me feel like it made me more appreciative of, like, the benefits of playing poker. Like, I think when poker had been the only job I had ever had, and I was surrounded, you know, 95% by poker players, it's easy to kind of get desensitized and not realize how fortunate of a situation you have. Like, even things like just, you know, getting to travel to these live tournaments, or, you know, if you want to wake up at 3 a.m., wake up at 3 a.m. If you want to wake up at 3 p.m., wake up at 3 p.m. Like, getting to, and if you want to work 80 hours in a week, or, you know, 8 hours in a month, you can do either of those. Like, that's the type of freedom that most people never really have. And it's something that, you know, being back in school, obviously school wasn't like an overly demanding schedule, but it is something that I didn't really realize how much I appreciate, or just how awesome it is to be able to choose to do what you want, when you want, all the time. I think that was a big thing. Yeah. I also just think that working for yourself is pretty sweet, and highly, I was underappreciating it. So I think just going back and, you know, being in, like, the real world, or at least, you know, a quasi real world in university for a year kind of helped me, you know, sort of see what the alternatives are like. And while I had fun in university, it made me, you know, take a lot of the smaller things in poker that I was taking for granted and appreciate them a lot more. And I think that, you know, I think since returning to poker, I think I've been, you know, way more grounded, way, like, you know, dealt with downswings better, like, been more appreciative of upswings. Like, you know, I think I've just approached it, like, more positively and less negatively than before.
So that's an awesome answer. And this is going to sound passive aggressive, and I absolutely swear it's not. You're playing online right now, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
Oh, you, crap. That sounded just like the do you have an alarm that sounds just like the 5 seconds to go alert from some poker site or the other?
My roommate's playing online right now.
Ah, okay. What's he playing?
One sec. Yo, Pratt, what are you playing right now? He's playing the 100 cube turbo and the 200 turbo.
All right. Tell him good luck. And if he has any really interesting hands, he should tell us about them so we can talk about them on the air. So
as a serious question or no?
I mean, I think coaching from you is pretty expensive. So if you were willing to talk about a hand on the air, I'd be pretty excited about it, and it would be fun in real time. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, totally agree.
Yo, Pratt, if there's any interesting hands, call me over, okay? He thinks it's a weird request, but sounds good.
I'll buy him a beer the next time we're both in Vegas. I'd appreciate it.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, so recognizing that we might get interrupted for some real-time strategy with Pratt, what was the point where you thought of yourself as like entering seriously into the poker world? I mean, you talked about the going back to school as like stepping out of it. What was the point where you really were saying to yourself, like, I am a poker player, like identifying yourself that way and thinking of it as something that you were doing pretty seriously?
For me, it was honestly quite a bit later. You know, it was later than I think it would have been for a lot of people. Like, I think it would have been, so basically I did 3 terms at university, while playing poker online. And then turned 18, and then decided I was going to take a year off and then play poker. If it goes super shitty, go back to school. If it goes well, stick with poker. Really, I wanted to just stick with poker, but that's kind of like what I told my parents, just as a way to make them more okay with it. Like for me, like I think a lot of people, you know, I'll see people who, you know, make 15K and then quit their job and go pro or something, or, you know, sometimes less. It's like, it's, you know, I've seen a lot of examples like that, but like at that point I had already made, like I had done extremely well before I was 18, like to the point that, I think since it had happened so quickly and since the money was all on the line, I didn't really realize just how well I had done. Yeah. Like, so I didn't really view myself as a poker professional, or that's like, it was my main hobby. And, you know, I put more hours into online poker than I was putting into, like, you know, my school at the time, but I still like wouldn't have really considered myself, you know, a pro poker player or anything like that, even though like honestly may have been like my winningest year ever or something. Like, it's, you know, if not certainly top 3.
Wow. And so that just all seemed kind of surreal to you because it was just like online and because you weren't really spending that much of it.
Like, I mean, if I wanted to, I could go get like whatever amount of money I wanted out of the bank, but I had no purchases, no expenses. I was just in university, like living in a meal plan, sleeping in like, you know, a single bed. The only purchase I had really made was like my computer and monitors. Didn't have a driver's license. Like, you know, the money just didn't really feel like money, if that made sense.
It does, but I wonder if it didn't. I mean, I feel like a lot of people in that same situation would, I guess, make an active effort to make it feel like money. I mean, just people who are like 17 years old who have access to that kind of money in a bank account, I feel like a lot of them would be tempted to move out of the college dorm into like an apartment, buy a fancy car, buy like luxury items. There was never any temptation to do that.
I did buy like, I bought like a $1,600 watch. I think that's about it. Like, I think I bought like a $400 pair of sunglasses. That's really about it as far as purchases I made back then. I mean, I didn't even have my driver's license when I won my EPT. So I couldn't get a car. I ended up getting a house, which, you know, is, I mean, it's not like, you know, a flashy purchase, but it's, you know, by far the biggest purchase I made. But as far as like, I was also pretty, like, I would just say just a pretty giant nerd back then, and didn't even know like what expensive clothes would be, kind of thing. So like, you know, honestly, if I was to give like Mike advice, it would probably be like, you know, dress better would probably be one of the things that I would say. And, you know, not even dress like fancy, but just like, don't wear, you know, shirts that you got when you were 14 years old to advertise the math camp where you found poker or something. Like, you know, it would just, you know, just stuff like that.
While you're back there, if you could also tell that to 16-year-old Andrew, that would be great.
Yeah, me too. I wore t-shirts all through college. It never even occurred to me not to.
Yeah. And also, you know, I couldn't, it's not like I could go, you know, spend money on alcohol. I'd never done any drugs, or like, you know, it's not like I could go like travel places. All my friends were broke college students as well, except for a few poker players. And those poker players, like Steve JPA, were like so grounded and like so like, you know, not ballers, that the atmosphere that I got into poker through was not one of the, you know, let's go to the strip club and spend 10K. Let's go, you know, buy these like 30K watches or and fly first class. Like, you know, we were, my friends made money, didn't spend it. So then it was kind of what happened with me is I just sort of like made money and didn't spend it and just kind of wanted to, you know, just be the best at it. I wasn't like, I was trying to think, all right, I want to make X so I can buy Y. It was more just like, I want to make X because that's more than the Y that I've made so far.
What about your parents? I mean, it must have seemed...
They thought it was pretty sweet. You know, they, I think they were, you know, I think they were just quite surprised from the get-go. I still think, you know, for the first little while, they definitely had something in their head where they like they wanted me to pull money offline because they figured, you know, I'm probably not going to, like, they figured at some point I'm going to start losing and lose a lot. Yeah. So they'd rather me have, you know, 10% of my net worth online than 75% of my net worth online kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Which I think is like a pretty good and like safe mentality for parents to have. And then I think that that kind of made my parents a little intimidated when I started playing live. Like, you know, live buy-ins are like astronomically higher than online buy-ins. And basically when I started playing live, I'm like, you know what? I think I'm like one of the best. I'm just going to play everything live. Like I was never, and like selling pieces wasn't as common back then. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really going from a mentality of, you know, my average buy-in's $200 online. You know, so I'm going to play like, you know, $200 tournaments live. It was like, you know, I'm like, these tournaments are super soft. Like I'm just going to play, you know, all the big live stuff. And I, you know, I wouldn't really, you know, swapping and selling pieces and stuff wasn't as common. So say in the first, you know, 3 or 4 months of playing live, I maybe, you know, went on like, you know, 200K downswing or something like that. Which is like, you know, not like, I definitely like ran pretty bad during those few months, but it was nothing like not a noteworthy downswing or anything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after one term, you know, my mom was like thinking, oh, Mike, like, you know, I know you said you're going to take a year off school, but how about you just go back to school now? And, you know, that was sort of like, you know, her mentality. And, you know, my dad was like, you know, sort of like on the fence. And, you know, in hindsight, they're sort of thinking like, that's probably the time when I need them to be the most supportive. Like it's easy to be supportive when like someone's winning, but like, you know, that's when, you know, your parents, you know, should be there for you the most. My mom was like, okay, well, you know, I was supportive when you were winning money. Now you're losing money. Go back to school. And then basically, like, you know, after that speech, like, you know, a week later or maybe 3 weeks later, went to Australia and won a tournament, got second in a tournament. And then another 2 weeks later, won an EPT. And then my mom's been supportive of poker ever since. So yeah, it's definitely been something where, you know, like I think that a lot of the support comes from, you know, the fact that it's gone so well. Like I think, you know, if I had have, you know, dropped out, like say I was that guy who dropped out after I made 15K to play professionally and, you know, was like, say I was grinding out a good living, like say I was making, you know, 60 or 70K a year or something, which is probably like similar to like what I would have made after university, you know, like probably like a more fun job, but like more like volatile and like less, you know, benefits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I feel like my parents wouldn't be that supportive, but I'm not sure. Like, I think there'd be a part of them where they'd want me to go back to school and get something more reliable, but I'm not certain about that.
Mm-hmm. So you said you jumped into the biggest stuff immediately just because you figured you were one of the best around. Do you still feel that way? Do you still play basically everything in sight? Are there tournaments you skip just for game selection reasons?
I mean, there are tournaments I skip for like rake reasons, like say are you guys familiar with like the current online schedule or no?
Not really. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Like, so basically Full Tilt is almost all regs, like, you know, Fish, I guess, don't trust Full Tilt, and like pros, you know, want more big buy-in tournaments. So they have a tournament on there that's sort of like, it's called the Supersize Sunday, which is a $635 tournament. You know, so it's like 6% rake on a 600 buy-in, and it's just like all good players pretty much. Like, there are tournaments like that that I'll skip. Like, I still think I'm, you know, better than the field, but like when it's not like an extremely good structure or anything, and it's like, it literally might just be like 92% professional players or something. I'll skip something like that. Sometimes I'll skip like, you know, 200 turbos or something, just, you know, largely rake related more so than not feeling like I'm winning in the field. And then also like 5K turbos live, like the EPTs. Actually, I'll mention this on the podcast just since like I like saying this in like, I don't know, public domains. The EPTs every year, they like upping their rake on turbos and hoping no one notices. And like, you know, now the rake on 5K turbos is like the same or in some cases even more, I think, than on their like main events. And it's just like when you're playing a 25 player turbo where it's almost all professionals and you're playing something that ends up being like, I don't know, a 4850 plus 450 or something like that, you're just like, you're really just like burning money. But like people keep playing them, and it seems like they've been shrinking for the most part as a result of this. So most of the things that I would skip would be just a result of, like, I think there are very few fields that I don't think I'm an above average player in, but there are definitely fields where I think that my, you know, edge isn't enough to overcome rake.
Makes sense. Of the people who play that $635 tournament on Full Tilt, what percent do you think are making a mistake by playing it?
So I would say that basically, I would guess, I don't know, 16 or 18% make money or something like that. But I would guess, you know, a lot of those, you know, it might be you're making $4 when if you go play a $50 tournament, you'd make $15 or something like,
right.
You know, so I would guess it's probably something like 95% are making a mistake by playing it.
Yeah, I would have guessed above 90%. It sounds like a bad proposition unless you have a huge bankroll and you just really love playing against the best players intrinsically, which is cool. I mean, maybe someday that'll be me. I could see myself doing that, but I mean, slightly wishful thinking, having a bankroll large enough to do that. But it sounds crazy. Do you think some of this is perverse incentives and a lot of those people are backed and looking to hit a big score and sort of know it's not responsible?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, sometimes being backed. Part of it, I think, is that, you know, because Full Tilt was down for a few years, not everyone knows everyone else's screen name on Full Tilt. So it's like, you know, if you're just like, you know, Google around, you might find their Pocket Fives profile and realize, hey, all these guys are the same guys I'm playing with on Stars day in and day out. So I think part of it is like if they had their Stars names up instead of their Full Tilt names, people would realize the field's tougher than it is. And then also there are things like people want to be high up on Pocket Fives, and these big buy-in tournaments are big for that. You know, being backed is big for that. Also, like a lot of people, you know, selling pieces, like some people will sell a Sunday package at 1.2 markup. And if you can sell off 80% of this tournament for 96% of the buy-in, like, sure, like you could be the worst player in the field and you're crushing that. So, you know, I think that, you know, I would guess a lot of people are playing it for reasons other than because they're, you know, they think they're making a big profit.
Yeah, that makes sense. I miss Bank of Timex so much. It's the best thing that ever happened on Twitter.
it was unfortunate, but it really seemed like, you know, I didn't really think about the, like, what exactly I was doing, that I was basically running a sports book and publishing like that on Twitter. Like I didn't realize it was going to get 2,000 followers and probably like six figures worth of action within like, you know, a couple of days. Like I just thought it was going to be a fun way for me to needle people in the 2+2 marketplace, and my friends would like laugh at it and favorite things. I didn't realize that, you know, it was going to take off the way it did, but you know, that'd be a very beneficial thing in poker.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I'm guessing there's probably some people listening to this who don't know exactly what that is. So I'll do my best to summarize it.
Poor souls.
What's that, Nate?
Poor souls.
Yeah. It was in fact, why don't you give us your summary of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, so in poker, people sell action and, you know, usually charge some degree of markup for their action. And, you know, sometimes they charge no markup, but, you know, they're, you know, even losing players in certain cases. But basically what Bank of Timex was it was an ulterior option to betting, like to investing in a player. And that's basically all like emulate their actions. So like, you know, if they lose $10, like, you know, you pay me $10. If they win $1,000, I pay you $1,000. So rather than it being paid out of a prize pool and it's, you know, getting paid out of my pocket. And, you know, the idea there is that if someone else is offering you a bad investment to invest through them, I'll come in and say, hey, I'll offer you a slightly better but still bad investment.
I see. Nate is trying to sell action in this $600 tournament at 1.2 and I'm getting ready to buy it, I can look on Bank of Timex first and I can see that you've offered to book his action at 1.1, and so I can buy it from you, get a better deal. And if you think that Nate isn't even worth 1.1, then I'm getting a better deal than I would be buying it from Nate, but you still think you're plus EV on that bet.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, can I offer a different way to think about it? Is that, like, if you're selling shares of yourself, there are two things you're doing. Like, number one, you're playing a tournament. And number two, you're selling a share of a certain asset at a certain price. And, of course, you can think about it in a certain way, like you sort of intrinsically have these shares of yourself as a player. But, like, you can just decouple those things, right? And you just say, oh, I'm playing the main event, and also I'm betting on this guy named Nate Mavis that, you know, if he does this, then I'll pay you that much, right? And then if I'm overvaluing that by selling it, like, Mike can enter that market and say, like, wait, you're paying 1.2 for Nate in this, like, $635 tournament? Like, sure, Nate's okay, but, like, he's not good enough to achieve that high in ROI. I'll sell you a similar asset at 1.18. And, you know, so there's just, like, this separate market in betting on how well Nate will do in the tournament. And the fact that one of the people entering that market happens to be Nate himself is not really material for the mechanics of the market, except for, like, taxation and things like that. But to a first approximation, I think that's the best way to explain it.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that would be material about it, which is the best argument that I've heard against allowing this kind of thing, is that when Nate Mavis wins, you know, let's say if you are selling in the main event, when you win $8 million for getting first place in the WSOP main event, you actually have $8 million because the WSOP cuts you a check for $8 million. Versus if the Bank of Timex crossbooks you and you win $8 million, you know, we don't necessarily know that the Bank of Timex has $8 million to pay out.
Yeah. I mean, that's an argument for not betting with people who can't pay or won't pay, but it's not really an argument that Mike was doing anything wrong. Anyway,
I don't mean to suggest that Mike was doing something wrong. I just mean a problem with, given that this is like a 100% unregulated market, I guess it's one of the potential problems, and I think one of the reasons why 2+2 doesn't allow that in the marketplace is related to this, I would assume.
Yeah, it seems right. It seems right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how important do you think it is, Mike, to have something? I mean, do you think it's a big problem that people are overvaluing their action, or do you just see it as an opportunity for someone capable of crossbooking?
I mean, it's sort of annoying. You know, like, it basically, I think it's just something like the people selling action for more than they're worth is just, it really seems like it hurts everybody, like, except themselves. Like, you know, it hurts the investors, obviously, who basically take on additional variance and decreased expectation. It also sort of like hurts the fields they're playing in, because a lot of these people, like, you know, say you're hopping in the supersized Sunday and you have a 5% ROI and you're selling at 1.2, your 5% ROI, you know, when you throw in rake, really you're beating the field for about 12%, and both the regs and the fish who, like, actually should be playing that on their own are then, like, losing to that 12% that you're taking out of the prize pool. So, like, with a lot of live tournaments, for people who, you know, are bankrolled to play in these bigger tournaments, you know, they, whether you're a professional player or, you know, an amateur player, you're both losing expectation to the, like, you know, the so-so regs who are getting to sell and be in these fields. Now, it would be one thing, you know, it would still be shitty for those people if they were selling at fair markups. Like, say you were selling at face for the supersized Sunday, you know, both the winning regs and the, like, you know, the fish would still rather you not be in the field. You know, from an EV point of view, the fish might actually want you in the field to have a bigger prize pool and stuff. But from an EV point of view, they wouldn't want you in the field, even if you're selling at a fair markup. But then when you throw in that you're selling at these increased markups, it basically means that, you know, a lot of these, you know, mediocre regs who are just, like, charging high markups will end up, you know, profiting more off these tournaments that become reg fests than the best players will be. Like, you know, if there's, say, a 215 turbo, you know, maybe the best player in the field is making, I don't know, let's say 18% or something, and then you have some losing player selling a piece at 1.25 and people are buying it. It's sort of crappy that, you know, the person who's just, you know, dishonest or maybe just naive and, like, willing to, you know, sell pieces at an unfair amount is profiting more than, the best players in the tournament are.
Yeah. And I'm not someone who follows the marketplace real closely myself. I know one of the arguments for allowing something like the Bank of Timex or cross-booking is that it generates competition so that people, it drives down the prices that people are able to get on their markup. But I would still think even in the absence of that competition, like over time, there would be kind of an evolutionary process where like the less savvy investors lose money and get out of staking and the more savvy investors aren't willing to buy overpriced markup and average markup tends to go down. Have you seen that kind of trend?
I think it's fairly slow just because variance is so big. I would say that your argument would be sort of like saying, well, if sports books only gave losing bets, eventually there'd be no sports books because the loser would lose, kind of thing. It's like that. Like people keep on betting because they keep on winning 96% of the time, kind of thing. I think, and also when the variance of MTTs, sometimes you'll have people make some of the worst invest. Like, let's just say there's a tournament where I have a great ROI. Like, say I have 100% ROI, but say I sell it 5-1 or something, even though I'm one of the players most likely to do well in the tournament with 100% ROI, at 5-1, I'm still like one of the worst investments. But if someone buys a piece of me and I win the tournament, then that person can now keep investing and keep, that'll encourage them to continue playing higher and higher markups to get, the type of players who they think are going to win the tournament. There's just so much variance that even if each investment they make is losing 15% or something, it's still pretty, it's like if you're a professional player and you're making 15% ROI on average in tournaments, you can still go on some pretty nasty downswings. So if you're like a bad investor losing 15% on, on each investment, you can go on equally big upswings.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I was thinking this year when I sell action for the main event, to do it auction style and just say minimum X percent, start the bidding at 1.1 and let the market determine it. Do you think that's a reasonable way for me to do it?
Yeah, a few people did that this year and I thought it was really good.
All right. Yeah, so Vincent did it and I guess
he was one of the guys I thought of. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it seems like a direction things might go to get the more market-like competitive aspect of the that you want. Without having to allow people cross-booking, which I guess 2+2 quite reasonably doesn't want people to do.
Yeah.
So kind of a left turn here on topics, but I was curious, when you first moved into playing live poker from online, how much did you feel like your online game translated into live poker, and what kinds of things did you feel like you had to, or what sort of skills did you feel like you were lacking?
This is going back, several years, I guess. Like, it's sort of tough to say in the sense that, as an example, back then I would probably c-bet like 95% of boards or something like that. And I could easily say, one of my leaks back then was, c-betting too much. But really, that was kind of like an exploitive tendency, taking advantage of the fact that people folded too much to c-bets back then. I think back then I was pretty shitty at poker, like probably horrible at poker by today's standards, but I think my edges against the fields are probably larger than they are today. So even though I sucked back then, like relatively I was pretty good back then.
Were you intimidated by like the idea of not having a poker face, or like this whole element of needing to read people being introduced into the game? Was that a scary thing for you when you first started playing live?
Not at all. Like my friends had run extremely good like early on in their live careers. Like, I had Steve Paul Ambrose had played, I'm not sure what the one is, let's say 100 hours of live poker, like a few live trips to play, a couple $100 tournaments and stuff. And then went to the PCA as his first major and won it.
Yeah.
And then my best friend in high school, he had literally played live poker twice. And when I say live poker, I mean one was like a $2 home game with friends. one was like a 1-2 underground game in our like hometown, which is like $100 buy-in or something. And like that was all of his Live Poker experience. And then he went to play his the Grand Prix de Paris in Paris and won that on his first time playing Live Poker. He didn't even know that you're supposed to like stack your chips by color or anything like that. You know, so after seeing stuff like that, I just figured like, you know, poker's poker, and if I just make the best decisions, like I'll be like making EV. And like, you know, this whole like, you know, looking into someone's soul, like I'm just like that doesn't exist. Like I'm just gonna go and play my game.
And going back and forth now between online and live poker, I mean, I guess I don't really know how much you do, but from what you mentioned about like evaluating the rake structure of online tournaments, I mean, it seems like you're still playing online tournaments with like 3-figure buy-ins. Yeah, I mean, just to put it bluntly, like, how does that make sense for you as someone who also plays tournaments with 5- and 6-figure buy-ins?
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of what it comes down to is like looking at these things from the terms of like expectation. So on a Sunday, I might play, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, but maybe I'll play, you know, my average buy-in might be $150 or something like that. But when, you know, that seems like nothing compared to a 10K live buy-in. But if I play 80, $150 tournaments, all of a sudden that's higher stakes than the 10K live tournament. And it's done, you know, obviously my best possible result isn't to win as much as winning the 10K live tournament. But like, you know, the stakes are similar and it takes one day instead of like 6 days. You know, I think that an average Sunday, I'm probably making a similar amount to like probably more than my average day of playing live poker kind of thing. Maybe similar. So I think it's basically, even though the best result isn't that high, it's still like, you know, I kind of just look at it from how much I think I'm making on average. And even what I'd say I'm at the point now in poker where even when the best result is really high, it's not going to, you know, change my day-to-day life that much. Like, right. You know, say like my PCA score is fantastic. And in 1 week, I made probably what my expectation is to make in about 3 years or something. Like it was like hugely substantial, but at the same time, like had I not, you know, say had I just lost the tournament, didn't cash it, like my life wouldn't really be any different right now. Like it's not like I'm ever going to have a situation where, you know, I'm Chris Moneymaker turning $40 into $2.5 million or anything like that. Like I don't really, like whether I'm playing poker to like increase my net worth by like, you know, by like 0.1% or by like 30% or whatever it happens to be, it's, you know, like obviously it's more exciting the 30% than the 0.1%, but it's still, you know, just trying to make the best decisions and knowing that regardless of how it finishes, you know, it's not going to, like if I have a really disappointing result, it's not like I've missed out on like, you know, a new life or, you know, changing things or things getting so much better. And it's not like if I won PCA as opposed to getting last place in PCA, it's going to, you know, night and day change my life or anything.
Yeah, or even your bankroll. I mean, because I think for some people having that potential upside of if I do really well in this tournament, then I can make a big step up in buy-in and increase my overall hourly rate. I guess that doesn't really exist for you either if you're already playing the biggest stuff that there is.
Yeah, I'm already playing, you know, the biggest tournaments. I would say, you know, winning PCA versus getting 10th, when I play in, like, super high rollers, I'll take a larger piece of myself, maybe buy some more pieces of friends. And then, you know, I know that, you know, the big games online, like, I'm just, you know, a straight loser. Like if, you know, even though something like some people could have a big score like this and be like, all right, now I'm going to go play, you know, sauce at 100, 200 heads up or something. Like I know my place in poker and I know that there are a lot of games where I'm going to get beaten pretty badly. So just, you know, just because I've like done well in some tournaments doesn't mean, and have the, you know, the bankroll to play bigger games doesn't mean that I like have any like reasonable shot at doing well in some of these other games. So I just like, you know, I just know that like, you know, where I'm at right now in poker, you know, I think reputationally pretty much regardless of what the tournament is, I'll find a way to play it kind of thing. Like if next year, you know, in Macau, they had a $5 million poker tournament kind of thing. like, I think that I would end up playing the tournament. You know, I'll end up having, you know, 3% of myself or something. Yeah. But like, it's I think basically reputationally in poker right now, I'll be able to play in any tournament that I want to play in, you know, ignoring rake and taxes and things like that. So yeah, I think that basically like whether I'm just playing online and, you know, winning a like 55 turbo for like 7K or getting second in PCA for $1 million, it's not, you know, it's not going to have giant changes to my life. Like obviously I'd rather get second in PCA by like, you know, 200 times or whatnot. But basically what I'm saying is that like I find it easy to take them seriously because I just know, you know, like this is my job. I want to do as well as I can playing poker. So like whether I'm playing in a $20 tournament or a $100,000 tournament, I play this game to make the best decisions I can. And you know, even if I fuck up in like a $22 tournament, I still feel stupid kind of thing. And I think it's, you know, I think it's not like I'm thinking, oh, it's only $22. It's like, oh, Mike, this is the thing you've worked the hardest at in your life and you're still not doing it well. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? So that, like, you know, so that's sort of the mentality that I take on, rather than being like, oh, it's only $22 or, oh, it's 100K. I need to focus on this.
So you said that you don't have the chance to make life-changing money. Do you do things that you do have a chance to make life-changing money in, or do you have plans to do it? Do you have plans to get into business or do other things that, you know, where you could, you know, triple your net worth in 2 weeks?
When they had that really big Powerball, I had like, I don't know, I forget what it was. I had a couple percent sweat of like 10,000 tickets or something like that. So, you know, that was a chance for some like life-changing money. You know, the World Series main is always like a chance for life-changing money. But, you know, I've made some other investments, but I'm kind of come from the perspective that like, if I see a good investment, you know, I'll invest something in it, but I'm not like a savvy investor and I know I'm not prepared to take the time to really seek out what are truly great investments or anything. So like, I'm never going to like, you know, see some company that I think is going great and then invest like a quarter of my net worth in it or something. Like I don't have enough faith in my ability to do anything besides play poker at this point to actually feel that I should be making large financial decisions.
I see. But you're a young kid. You could study these things. Like if your goal were to make life-changing money for you now, it might well make more sense to learn finance, learn business, learn venture capital, something like that, and then emerge a couple years later with more knowledge and the bankroll that you have now. But that's not what you're doing. Yes.
Yeah. That's a good point that you raise. And I think that I would guess that for me, the time, you know, looking at both, you know, the difficulty of games, my work ethic as a player, and, well, you know, my financial position, I would guess, you know, sometime, I don't know, it could be as early as a year ago, it could be as late as 2 to 3 years from now, but at some point, I think my time financially would be better spent, you know, learning the stock market, learning real estate, learning something else as a means of, like, investing, like, what I have. But on the other hand, like, I'm in a good enough position as it is right now, and I still, like, I don't have, you know, that high of like financial goals for myself. Like I want to do well playing poker. But you know, if my net worth was, you know, 100 times what it is right now, you know, I think my like quality of life would be like under double kind of thing. Like, you know, they're like, maybe I'm really naive about thinking that way. But they're very, you know, when I'm, you know, there are very few things that like happen where I just think like, hey, you know, if I had unlimited money, I would be doing this differently.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you look at my life, I'm not maximizing money either. And if I woke up tomorrow with 100 million, like I might do some things differently, but I can't imagine my life would be that much better, you know, and I don't have nearly the money that you have, of course, but yeah, I at least see the point. And, given all the lifestyle benefits of poker, it makes sense that you're doing what you're doing. But when you said like, oh, it's easy for me to focus on these tournaments, you know, similarly, because neither one of them figures to change my overall financial position. You know, it makes one wonder if, you know, reaching other strata of wealth really is a goal for you. And kudos for you that it's not really.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I would say as like the last couple of years, and this is, I mean, part of returning to school is me thinking, you know, what should I do to like increase my happiness? And then part of like, you know, leaving school is being like, what should I do to increase my happiness? Like my goal is usually find things that I enjoy doing and do them. Rather than, you know, maximizing expectation. Like I just found out yesterday. So I started rock climbing this summer. And I'm like, I'm pretty bad at it. Like I,
you got 12th from last. Okay. You're not that bad. You got like,
yeah, I got 12th from last. What ended up happening is, so they have these, you compete by your university. And like the university that I went to, their team, like only one person's like actually a student there. Like some people are still in high school. Some people have already graduated. Some people like me started and didn't finish, but still have a valid student card. The team basically is like consists of, you know, some students, some non-students. And basically there are different time slots for when you can compete. And there's like beginner, intermediate, and like advanced. And the guys basically said that I should be in like beginner or intermediate. But what happened is you climb at different time slots and they were all climbing in advance. So they said if I want to get advice from them, I should just climb in advance and come last. It's like going in, I expected I was going to come last. And there were a couple people who got like did not finishes. And then I got like fourth last of people who finished. So I was actually pretty pleased with that result. But it was like going in, most people are like way better than me. And like, I'm never going to like go anywhere with this. Even if I was number one in the world at rock climbing, I think I would probably do like worse than I am playing poker kind of thing, but I just really enjoy it. And I found out the next rock climbing competition falls on the same day as WPT Fallsview. And, you know, that would be like my next like live trip. I'm certain I'm going to play. But like, you know, I enjoyed these rock climbing competitions so much. I'm pretty sure I'll just go participate in that and then just like late register Fallsview, like, you know, maybe miss the first 4 hours or something. But like, even though that's a high expectation thing and my expectations way higher playing Fallsview, which is, by the way, such a soft tournament, than it is, you know, rock climbing where my expectations, you know, minus $8 an hour or whatever it costs to compete. I just know that I'll enjoy my day more if I do both, then if I just do the one that, you know, pays better.
What is it that that you like so much about climbing?
I think the one thing I like about it is it's a ton of problem solving. It's sort of, you know, you use your, like, you know, it's kind of like the limitation, like it, you use your mind to sort of figure out like the limitations of your body. I think I've always kind of flocked pretty well towards individual sports as opposed to team sports. I've always played some team sports as well, but I find, you know, I like, you know, having only myself to blame when things, you know, don't go well. And I think that, you know, this is, and I've also, you know, I've always done some strength training, for at least for the last like 5 or 6 years. And I think this is kind of a cool way of, you know, utilizing the strength from like, you know, weightlifting and now focusing on, you know, getting a better like strength to weight ratio. And trying to improve at this. It's also, I think the fact that, you know, so often you'll fail at something so many times and then finally get rewarded by getting to the top, you just get such a massive like dopamine release. And I think that's pretty similar to playing poker. Like I think everyone who's played poker and, you know, you've been in that situation where you're trying to figure out if the guy's bluffing the river and then, you know, you're correct and you win some big pot because you made a, you know, a good read or, you know, deduced his range well or whatever it happened to be. You're just so used to getting these dopamine spikes that I think that most poker players, myself included, like flock towards things where you get kind of that like auto gratification. And I think rock climbing works pretty well for that. Like you kind of work towards a problem, try out a few things, and sort of the more times you fail, the more, you know, satisfied you are when you finally get to the top.
I'm not real acquainted with climbing myself, but I have some friends who are pretty into it. And to hear them talk about it, it's also a very kind of flow-like experience, or the sort of thing where you're just so focused on the task immediately ahead of you, and sort of everything else is shut out of your mind. I guess they would describe it as kind of meditative. I mean, do you find it to be that way? And if so, is that also something that you get out of poker?
Yeah, so I would say as far as being meditative, I wouldn't describe poker as being meditative, for me at least. And I would say with climbing, I can definitely sort of see it becoming that way. For me, I still haven't like perfected all the moves. I still have like, you know, flaws in my footwork, and you know, there are a lot of things that I'm still somewhat in the beginner phase. But I can I think that's a pretty common thing amongst like more experienced climbers, where you kind of, once you get fairly good, you just sort of get into a rhythm where you know, for me, I don't even always know what I have to do, but once you almost always know what you need to do, and then you're just kind of, you know, like figuring it out, and you kind of get into a better rhythm, I could definitely see it being more, you know, meditative or zen-like or whatever you want to call it.
I'm sure everyone is eager to talk strategy with Mike freaking McDonald. I don't want to take up too much of your time before we get there, but I do want to tell you a little bit about Tournament Poker Edge. And specifically, I want to make sure people know that I have a new series going up on Tournament Poker Edge right now. If you aren't already a member, or maybe you were a member and you've let your membership lapse because I haven't had any videos on there for a while, I'm sure that was enough to drive thousands of you away from TPE. I do have a new series going up right now. It's kind of a continuation of some previous series that I've done on hand reading and on value betting. This one deals with bluffing. I think that's something that pretty much everyone needs to work on, no matter how good you are. And it talks a lot about the theory of bluffing, also goes into some examples of different types of bluffs. But overall, it's really about how you should be thinking about bluffing in general. I think it's something that just about anyone could find very useful, and you will find it only on tournamentpokeredge.com. And I got a question from a friend of mine who I was actually supposed to talk with him tonight. He was kind of my backup plan. If this didn't come through for tonight, I was going to talk with him. And I told him, and he had no problem with being a backup plan to Mike McDonald. But he did. he gave me this question to ask you that I thought maybe we could start here. And if it's a little broad, we might want to find a way to zero in a little bit more. But okay. He said, please ask Mike about this hyper-aggressive small ball style that's becoming popular lately. Dudes are opening like 40 to 50% of hands from all positions and betting like a third pot until the caller gives up. I can exploit them if I have position and they're doing it to me, but if I am not in the hand, they absolutely run over the table. They chip up and I eventually end up in push fold mode. Yesterday, I saw a guy defend with 7-2 off and stab with air when I checked back my ace. That's going to work for him versus most villains. The final table is everything. If I can't beat him, maybe I should join him. Can you ask Mike for advice on how I can do that?
I guess that's a few questions in one. The first thing I'll say is that the hyper aggressive play 50% of hands, bet really small in all situations, I don't really understand that style myself. that's not the answer that anyone wants to look for, but like when the way that, you know, I'd say most of my friends, a lot of whom are some, like a lot of the biggest live winners and also like very consistent online players as well, play is just pretty similar to each other and like grossly different from how some of the biggest online winners play. I honestly, like, I can't really explain it. Like some of the biggest online winners just, you know, just click around, and I feel like if they're watching me, they'll almost never be like, oh, Mike has these leaks, which I'm exploiting. And if I'm watching them, I feel like I'm constantly like, all right, he has these leaks, which I'm exploiting, but somehow, like, you know, they win seven times as many tournaments as I do. Like, there are certain things that I would say, like, you know, when you mentioned him defending 7-2 off and then taking a stab, which would work against a lot of people. Well, first of all, like when people are defending too wide, I think if you're checking back routinely, which a lot of people do, like, you know, the way your friend like worded, I check back my ace, it's, you know, it sounds to me as if, you know, I'm not certain about this, but your friend may be playing like two showdown bound of a strategy. And like, you know, as an example, let's just say you never c-bet, you never bet the turn, you never bet the river. Well, then what happens is when you min raise and someone's in the big blind, they're getting 4.5 to 1. So like, unless they know they have unders to your overpair, they should call any cards regardless of your cards, basically. And the reason that defending 7-2 off or 3-2 off or whatever becomes unprofitable is because you make it tough for them to recognize their equity. Like, you know, 3-2 off beats ace king a fair bit. Like 3-2 off, you know, 3-2 off beats ace 2 suited a fair bit. Like, you know, when you're getting such good odds out of the big blind, you should be playing very loose, especially against, you know, people who either who have small betting post flop or, you know, don't see bet or bet turn enough, or as is often the case, like fold too often to turn bets when they don't see bet. So basically what I would just say is, yeah, like I think that, you know, the guy defending 7-2 off might not even be that bad of a play. Probably it's a bad play, but like there definitely have been situations where I've defended 7-2 off as well. And a lot of people who are, you know, too straightforward post flop or fold too much post flop or c-bet too small post flop will open themselves up to people just recognizing their equity with too many hands. So that would be one thing. The second thing, like, you know, people playing 50% of hands from all positions, it sounds to me like, you know, given what your friend said, those are really soft. Like, that sounds like a really soft table if, you know, 7 of the 8 opponents aren't adjusting and if he's the only one who's willing to stand in the way and make things difficult for the person. You know, really, I'd say the best adjustment is the pots that they aren't in. If the other 7 guys aren't exploiting this aggro villain, you know, when the pots he isn't in, you should be an aggro villain yourself. And, you know, play, you know, a large number of pots if everyone else is playing too tight.
Right. Like, assuming that it's working for that guy, then presumably it would work for you as well in the hands that he's not getting involved in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think there's anything like they see, oh, this guy's got, you know, a dog in his avatar. You have no avatar. All right, he's going to, you know, not get the dog avatar. Like, there's, you know, there, you know, most, like, if anything, you know, the aggressive player with a reputation for being aggressive, you know, people are more likely to play back against. And if your friend is a tighter player, if he goes and just, you know, starts playing half of hands, he's going to do better with that strategy than, you know, than the hyper aggressive reg will.
Mm-hmm. Well, now part of the reason that, I mean, people are able to get away with playing so many hands though is that they are risking so little. Like, once their ante is out there as well, with a minimum raise, you're risking so little relative to the pot that, you know, any reasonable chance of winning it post pre-flop combined with some chance of winning it post-flop, whether or not at showdown, can end up making that profitable. And regarding the discussion of like calling with 7-2 offsuit out of the big blind, do you think that the trend towards really small raises is theoretically correct, or more a way of like exploiting people in the big blind who aren't very good at either recognizing what they should be calling with or how they defend pre and post flop?
I would say more generally than exploiting the big blind, I think small raises just exploit opponents who aren't focusing enough. Like, you know, if everyone at the table is 100 big blinds deep, you know, and 24 tabling, min raising under the gun, I don't think is that bad. But if everyone's like very good and one tabling live, I think min raising under the gun is pretty bad at that, like with that stack depth, because not only are you, you know, basically assuming the big blind is going to fold too much, you're assuming the guys behind are going to fold too much as well. Like, you know, the guys, like if you're under the gun with 100 big blinds and the button has 100 big blinds, like if you get post flop, you know, with 6 big blinds out there, 94 effective, he or 98 effective, the guy on the button has a pretty big advantage over you. Like, you really, you know, you basically need to accept the fact that, you know, he should have a wider range, you should have a tighter and stronger range, and if he's playing his wider range against you, you should be, you know, exploiting him playing a wider range by jacking up the pot size. Like, you know, the way, you know, you see people opening like 7-6 off under the gun because like because they're stupid, or you know, like,
or you get tested.
Or you know, they think that they're a genius and that everyone else is dumb, or whatever it happens to be. But like, really, you know, when there's, you know, capable players behind with deeper stacks, you know, you're not really setting yourself up very well by just min-raising a lot. Like, obviously, you can just, you know, remember the times it got through, or remember when your c-bets worked, or maybe you're at a table where people just like fold like ace queen to your opens, or who knows what. But in general, like, yeah, you're not only exploiting the big blind folding too much, but you need to be exploiting, you know, under the gun one, under the gun two, you know, all the way through the button folding too much as well. So yeah, I just think that I it's like, I've definitely in the last few years in the tougher tournaments, there's been more and more of a tendency towards larger opens, and I think that's going to continue. You know, it's pretty common in super high rollers to see people raising over 3x preflop, and you just like, you like, you'll go, you know, I'll go and play, you know, a tournament online, or you know, like a main event on like live or whatever it happens to be, and everyone will be like min raising, and they'll be, you know, 200 big blinds deep, three betting from two big blinds to 4.5 big blinds out of position or something like that. And then you'll go play that same situation, a super high roller. It'll be like, you know, a guy will open 3.2x and get three bet to 13x or something like that. And like, if you were to like change these guys, and instead of making them, you know, look like Isaac Hacks and make them look like 70 years old, all these like on like mediocre online kids would be like laughing at them kind of thing. but like, you know, there's, but really, yeah, it's definitely, there's a trend over the last, you know, 6-7 years for sizing to get smaller and smaller and smaller. But I think it's gone too far, and in a lot of cases is wrong now.
Are you familiar with Poker Snowy?
Yeah, I don't have it, and I haven't used it, but like I should.
Yeah, because that's and this was surprising to me, and I think to a lot of people that and I mean, Poker Snowy doesn't play tournaments, but I would think if anything, the argument for raising bigger would apply even more in cash. Maybe not though, because there aren't the antes. But in any event, Poker Snowy min raises from all positions except the button and makes a pot size raise on the button, which I found to be surprising.
Oh wow, that's, yeah, I would not have guessed that. That's interesting. I have no idea.
To be fair, bet sizing is not one of the things that they've studied maybe in as much detail as they want to study. Is that right?
Well, I mean, it does have the option of making a half pot raise, a pot size raise, or a 2x pot raise. And I mean, presumably the preflop stuff converges a lot more quickly than postflop stuff. So I mean, in my time playing around with Poker Snowy, I've seen some kind of strange behavior in like river situations or multi-way pot situations, which I think probably relates to just those kinds of things not converging as quickly. But I mean, I would think that it's at least experimented pretty thoroughly with, you know, at a 5-10 game, opening to 20 versus opening to 35, with a variety of ranges from a variety of positions. I would guess that that's a spot it's explored pretty thoroughly. And yeah, granted, it hasn't explored opening to 25, it hasn't explored opening to 30, but even the fact that it's choosing 20 over 35 is maybe significant, especially given that it made an opposite choice when it had the button and in no other seat.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. Like, it's, I don't know, it's pretty likely that all of what I said is just wrong then. Like, I tend to assume, you know, like, from what I've heard from friends, Poker Snowy is like pretty damn good. So yeah, I like, it's not as if like I'm going to have an argument against what Poker Snowy is doing, or it's not as if I'm going to all like be in agreement. Like, I mean, basically, you know, that's one thing that's kind of like cool about poker, is that there is no, we're not at a like, it's, and it's fortunate for all of us that we're not in a state in poker where there are definitive answers. Like, you know, where there are like, you know, people making their best approximations, but yeah, like it's certainly possible that, you know, Snowy's right and I'm like dead wrong. It's quite probable.
So are you like licking your chops when you sit down at a table, at least in like a relatively high buy-in tournament, and are seeing people making the min raises? I mean, do you look at that and say like, I know exactly what that person's doing and how to deal with it?
I mean, it's by no means licking my chops. Like, I'd much rather just, like, see someone who clearly doesn't know what they're doing kind of thing. but, like, I definitely...
That's why I specified, like, a higher buy-in tournament, though, as opposed to having, I don't know who you'd consider them, but, I mean, the people you're talking about who you consider some of the better players and super high rollers who make the bigger raises. I mean, do you look at the people making the small raises and say to yourself, you know, that guy is making a mistake that I have a pretty clear idea of how to exploit?
Yeah, I do feel like that happens in, you know, say something like an EPT high roller. Like, an EPT high roller will have, say, 150 players, of which, you know, maybe 30 are randoms and 120 are professional poker players, something like that. And then of those 120 players, they'll kind of be, you know, varying levels of ability. And I feel like, you know, after playing, say, like a super high roller tournament, you'll have the 30 to 40 guys in that tournament who seem to play, you know, usually like somewhat similarly to each other, like, not, you know, not like same ranges or same sizings, but like, you know, some degree of similarity. But I feel like the majority of the guys who, like, you know, will take shots at EPT high rollers and stuff will, you know, have a lot of just like sizing things that I feel like will be, you know, fairly exploitable. By no means like licking my chops, but I feel like in some of these super high rollers, there are plenty of players where I feel like there's almost nothing they do that I'm getting substantial edges off of. And I feel like, you know, outside of a few dozen guys, they're, you know, most people, I feel like, I'm not to say that, you know, I'm getting an edge off them and they're not getting an edge off me, but I'm saying there are definitely spots where I feel like, you know, they're making mistakes that I'm definitely exploiting.
If you don't mind going into too much detail about like how you're exploiting that sort of thing, and maybe I'll ask first, do you? I mean, are you okay with talking more about this?
I guess this is definitely getting like more strategic than like I wanted to get on the podcast. Okay.
We should let you off the hook then. But unless you're willing, I don't know. I won't stop you.
Yeah, sure. I'll let her finish the sentence.
I would just say, you know, like there's some people, I would say a lot of, you know, as far as say just looking at preflop tendencies, you know, some people, like, it's pretty common that people defend their blinds too little, fold to too many three bets, three bet too much, like fold to too many four bets, like raise too much from early, call too much with too weak of a range against opens, like, and like a pretty like unbalanced range, you know, like basically, you know, those, like, I would say those would all be like pretty standard tendencies that, you know, most to all players will have, you know, one or more of those. And then, you know, just realizing like, hey, like this guy's value range when three betting is just too wide. Like, you know, someone opens under the gun and like he three bets nines on the button, 80 bigs deep or something, you know, something like that. Then you can be like, all right, you know, anytime this guy flats an open, when you squeeze, he's basically dead money kind of thing. Mm. You know, they're definitely just lots of like situations you can come across that are, you know, they're more, I don't know, like they're not like complex, but you know, they're more complex than the standard, all right, well, these guys never play hands, so if I min raise, I'll pick up the blinds kind of thing. Like there's, you know, that, like that's like there are legitimately games that are soft enough where that's what's necessary to win. But I think that, you know, I think that as you get into like regular tables, the things that you need to take advantage of are just like less like apparently obvious.
So this maybe is something that you can talk about in a little less depth or specificity. What's an interesting frontier, an interesting problem for you in poker strategy now? Like what kinds of things do you work on to improve your own game?
I mean, honestly, like I would say right now, like when I was saying how my expectation going forth in poker could be higher focusing on the stock market, I would say my work ethic in poker is like, it's not as high as it could be. Like I think that there were, you know, a couple of years ago, I would definitely be, you know, like, you know, grinding hours of like, you know, trying to compare the EV of, you know, different plays or whatnot, or like different, you know, unconventional things. Nowadays, it's mostly just, you know, discussing hands over Skype with my friends. Like there's not really, there's not like, I feel like in poker there, I don't get that many like aha moments anymore. I occasionally do, and it's always like sweet when I do. But there aren't, you know, there aren't that many like giant changes that I'm making to my game or the things I'm doing to improve. Like especially when tournaments are still, you know, still quite soft and so exploitive. Like I would say that, you know, my strategy, like I still think it's far from like, you know, needing like a GTO type strategy to succeed. It's so often just, you know, being there and being like, all right, you know, do I think he has it or do I think he doesn't? I don't mean to say that like that's all that like poker is, but I do think that, you know, like if you're just like, especially in live tournaments, if you're just a few percent better at guessing right, that's a lot more valuable than, you know, say having slightly more perfect ranges.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, is there an example you can give of like what was an aha moment for you, either recently or like further back in your career?
Would like basically like if you ask me what's an aha moment in your career, like I can, you know, think of like things that are,
it would be like trivial now.
Not even trivial now, but are useful now. But it's not like a big, like, you know, big change to my game kind of thing. Like, I mean, I guess like a simple one would be this is something that like my friends and I have been like arguing back and forth about recently, is like when it comes to like betting the river, you should bet because you think you're going to get called by worse, not because you think you're going to look stupid because you're not smart enough to value bet. I think that there's very few people, like, you know, I think that when playing poker, very few people make big checks enough. Like, you know, that's something like, you know, that's like everyone, you know, everyone thinks it's cool to go for the thinnest value you possibly can, but oftentimes you just need to accept, hey, like I've got the best hand, like, you know, like 90% of the time, and he's going to, you know, maybe call me with worse 2%, like check raise me for value 4%, and check raise me as a bluff 4% or something like that. Like there's certain situations, especially against tough players, when, you know, they have a rough idea of your range, you have a rough idea of their range, when even though you're almost always best, you're like, you just like can't bet. Like I feel like so often I just see people, you know, bet hands, then feel bad when they get check raised, and then call with a hand which they could have just, you know, checked and won with, like most of the time. Or yeah, like it's like today I was playing, I mean, this isn't a great example of a hand, this is actually a fairly like stupid hand, but I was playing a hand today. I misclicked and limped, and then someone over limped, and he's a reg, and then someone in the blinds called. I had king two off. This is just online in some, I don't know, $100 tournament or something, but this is like a reg who's usually pretty decent. The flop comes queen 9-2. Check, I bet, button calls, other guy folds. The turn is a two. I feel like he's always going to bet when check two. I didn't think he'd be calling. I figured when the flop's multi-ways, when he calls the flop, he has a queen a decent amount more than a nine. Like I figured he'd fold some nines on the flop. So I check, just expecting he'd bet. I can check call and then check raise. And then so he checks back. So when he checks back, I figure, you know, he's got a weak queen or a nine, since I figured with most of his like gut shots or straight draws, he would just bet turn with. The river's a four. I check. He thinks a little while and bets like 40% pot or something. And I just check raised for like six times his bet or something like that. And I think it's a situation here where, like, you know, he bets this river knowing that he's got like a weak range, but he's like, oh, draws missed, I'm going to bet with second pair and get some thin value here, or, you know, weak top pair, get some thin value. And then I bomb check raise, and it's a spot where, like, you know, I know that he has no nut hands. I mean, unless he had like pocket fours and just like river to boat. But he basically has like no nut hands. he doesn't really know that I don't have nut hands, but like he usually has the best hand the way the hand played out, which is why he value bet. But like he shouldn't be betting the river because he usually has the best hand. He should be betting the river because when I put in money on the river, he usually has the best hand. So eventually he just called because he was confused. And, you know, on queen 9-2, 2-4, he just bet called the checkers with jack 9 and lost to my king 2 off. And it's just like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, that's a fortunate set of circumstances for me to, you know, to be in and to, like, win that pot. But it's just like, you know, it's so easy to just check back a 9 there. Like, you know, even though a 9 there is going to be good, like, 80% or something, it's not as if, like, it's not like I really, like, am going to be heroing the river or anything like that.
And he knows that it's you, right?
Yeah.
So, like, what kind of asshole does he think you are that you're calling with so many hands worse than Jack Nine when that action happens on the river? Like, I feel like that's almost like a disrespectful play towards you to think that he's going to be able to get a value bet there.
Yeah. No, it's definitely fairly, you know, like insulting, I guess. Another hand that just actually my roommate and I played a tournament against each other yesterday, and we each had a bunch of nut hands that we like had to like check back against each other. Like we were sort of thinking that like people at the table might have even thought we were like colluding with each other because it was like a satellite, and we like both of us don't really value bet the river. so the one hand that happens, like I raise cutoff or hijack, he defends the big. The flop comes 7-2-2 with the 7-2 of diamonds. He checks. I c bet. He calls. Turn is a queen. He checks. I bet like 60% pot. He calls. The river is the king of diamonds. And now here, basically, like, I mean, if I bet the river and he calls me with a seven, like that's pretty like disrespectful. Like, you know, it's not like. It's, you know, if I just have a random hand, I'm doing pretty damn well against a seven. And there's so many things that beat a seven here. And also they're just like when he check calls the turn, like I think he would fold a decent number of like pocket fives or a seven X type hands on the turn. Even there's just going to be his range has a large number of flush draws. Like, you know, I would guess on this river, you know, I have the best hand like 80% of the time or something still, like because of, you know, enough 7x hands or, you know, hands where he like, you know, called ace queen or something and turned to queen or whatever it happened to be. I still have the best hand the majority of the time, but it's so easy for him to have a flush draw. And it's also easy for him to have, say, like ace of diamonds 7 and just like check shove on me kind of thing. Like if I bet river, you know, really when I bet this river, even though like king queen is, you know, obviously doing really well. It's just easy to be up against a flush, and it's easy for him to pretend that he has a flush if he doesn't have a flush. So like I check back river, and you know, like when I check back river, I'm like, all right, you know, pot's like coming my way. It's not like I'm like, oh, I think you have a flush, so I'm checking. It's, oh, I think when you put money in on the river, you're going to have a flush a decent amount of the time or a rep a flush, and I don't have a good hand for bet calling a check raise. Like if I had, I don't know, if I had a blocker to a diamond, like say I had king jack with the jack of diamonds, my hand's going to be good at showdown basically exactly the same amount of the time. Like the only difference would be if he has king seven probably, or if he had like, ace king, like basically they're like pretty much identical strength hands on that board, like king jack with the jack of diamonds. Now I block a good chunk of his flush draws. It's like by having the jack of diamonds blocker. Mm-hmm. So now like when I get check raised, a larger percent of his check raises will be bluffs. So like, you know, maybe if Poker Snowy plays this hand out, Poker Snowy checks king queen and bet calls king jack of diamonds or something, like it's, or king jack with a diamond. Like it really is just a situation where
the blocker value is more important than the absolute value of the hand.
Exactly. And like, I think when people see it, like, especially when playing live, you see a lot of like so-so regs look down at the river and see that they've got a sweet hand and like they just feel that they have to bet it because like people just don't like the idea of, you know, not value betting aces on the river, not value betting like a set on the river when like, you know, but when there's, especially when you have a lot of the cards on board, like, you know, a good example would be, I think one of the best examples of this is if someone check calls you on like, you know, ace, 8-2 with the flush draw or something like that, and you have pocket aces, if you bet the flop, they call, you bet the turn, they call, the river completes the flush and they check, like, what the fuck are they going to call you with kind of thing? You know, like every, like you have top set, so like it's tough for them to have top pair. When the flush gets there, a lot of their top pair hands aren't that going to be that great. You know, some of these boards, it like, you know, you might be right. Like it might be, you know, if you have bottom two pair, you know, it's an easy value bet, but with top set, it's an easy check. But like a lot of people, you know, don't think about it that way. They just, you know, they just see top set, especially top set of aces, and just feel like, you know, the goal of pocket aces is to win a big pot. And if you have another ace on board, it's easier to win a big pot. And so, you know, people get in these situations where they just like see a good hand and feel that they need to keep betting it. But yeah, it's like really just thinking about what they can call you with or what they could bluff raise you with. And if you want to get bluff raised, like you really need to, I guess you just need to, I would just say one of my aha moments is rather than just thinking, do I have the best hand? Okay, bet the river. To think about what can they actually have and how, like, what am I happy with their, you know, non-folding river options?
Yeah, and I imagine that's an especially important consideration in tournaments and even more so in satellites where, as when you're talking about a large bet or a bet that represents a good chunk of your stack, you have a little bit of risk aversion also where you want to be not just like a 51% favorite against this calling range. And like, likewise, he has a little bit of risk aversion for making a call for a large chunk of the stack or a large number of chips where he wants to, you know, be getting slightly better than the bare minimum odds he needs to call, which makes it a little harder for you to make thin value bets and maybe also makes you a little more susceptible to bluffs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, you really, Yeah, like in satellites, you just, part of it is just minimizing the variance as well. This wasn't some big like multi-seat satellite or anything like that. Like it was like, I don't know, 7 left, 2 seats or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's still, you know, it still is, you know, something to keep in mind that very close decisions, taking the lower variance option often makes more sense in satellites than in normal tournaments.
Yeah, I'd say that this is probably going to constitute an aha moment for quite a few people listening to this and to some extent for myself even.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Thank you. Anything else that we didn't get a chance to talk about that you would like to?
Anything else like Turbo Rake that you just want to like? Are there any people you need to publicly denounce? Like this is, you can just use this as your soapbox if you want.
Yeah. I mean, Turbo Rake is definitely one of the biggest ones. Like turbos are so, especially with T-Coup going on right now. Turbos are so much fun, but yeah, they definitely. You know, it's sort of dumb that in, especially like live tournaments, you know, you charge rake on a tournament because, you know, you need to have like pay the staff and pay the dealers and stuff like that. But it's kind of ridiculous. Like, you know, at PCA, it's $10,300 to play the PCA, of which you have, you know, hundreds of dealers dealing for like a whole week. And then the PCA turbo at the end of the week, which takes 5 hours, is also $10,300. Like it's, you know, it's sort of ludicrous that the tournament that's the whole festival that's like, you know, PokerStars, like, you know, like number one event, you know, you pay the same fee to play it as you do to just play some like little like reg fest tournament off in the corner of the room that's done in a few hours.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
Fair complaint. That's well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You were extremely generous with us, and I really appreciate it. I know Andrew does too.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
All right, and good luck in your climbing competition.
Oh, thanks. Take care.
Yeah, take care. Bye. Tapping on my window pane. Take away the pain.
the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign?